Listening Library presents A Long Way from Chicago by Richard Peck. Read for you by Ron McClary.
Prologue. It was always August when we spent a week with our grandma. I was Joey then, not Joe. Joey Dowdle, and my sister was Mary Alice. In our first visits, we were still just kids, so we could hardly see her town because of Grandma. She was so big, and the town was so small. She was old, too, or so we thought, old as the hills. And tough. She was tough as an old boot, or so we thought. As the years went by, though, Mary Alice and I grew up, and though Grandma never changed, we'd seem to see a different woman every summer. Now, I'm older than Grandma was then, quite a bit older. But as the time gets past me, I seem to remember more and more about those hot summer days and nights, and the last house in town where Grandma lived. And Grandma. Are all my memories true? Every word. And growing truer with the years. Shotgun Cheatham's Last Night Above Ground, 1929. You wouldn't think we'd have to leave Chicago to see a dead body. We were growing up there back in the bad old days of Al Capone and Bugs Moran. Just the winter before, they'd had the St. Valentine's Day Massacre over on North Clark Street. The city had such an evil reputation that the Thompson submachine gun was better known as a Chicago typewriter. But I'd grown to the age of 9, and my sister Mary Alice was 7, and we'd yet to see a stiff. We guessed that most of them were where you couldn't see them, at the bottom of Lake Michigan, wearing concrete overshoes. No, we had to travel all the way down to our Grandma Dowdle's before we ever set eyes on a corpse. Dad said Mary Alice and I were getting to the age when we could travel on our own. He said it was time we spent a week with Grandma, who was getting on in years. We hadn't seen anything of her since we were tykes. Being Chicago people, Mother and Dad didn't have a car, and Grandma wasn't on the telephone. "They're dumping us on her, is what they're doing," Mary Alice said darkly. She suspected that Mother and Dad would take off for a week of fishing up in Wisconsin in our absence. I didn't mind going, because we went on the train. The Wabash Railroad's crack Bluebird that left Dearborn Station every morning, bound for St. Louis. Grandma lived somewhere in between, in one of those towns the railroad tracks cut in two. People stood out on their porches to see the train go through. Mary Alice said she couldn't stand the place. For one thing, at Grandma's, you had to go outside to the privy. It stood just across from the Cobb House, a tumble-down shed full of stuff left there in Grandpa Dowdle's time. A big old snaggle-toothed tomcat lived in the Cobb House, and as quick as you'd come out of the privy, he'd jump at you. Mary Alice hated that. Mary Alice said there was nothing to do, and nobody to do it with, so she'd tag after me, though I was 2 years older, and a boy. We'd stroll uptown in those first days. It was only a short block of brick buildings, the bank, the insurance agency, Moore's store, and the Coffee Pot Cafe, where the old saloon had stood. Prohibition was on in those days, which meant that selling liquor was against the law. So people made their own beer at home. They still had the tin roofs out over the sidewalk and hitching rails. Most farmers came to town horse-drawn, though there were Fords, and the banker, L.J. Weidenbach, drove a Hupmobile. It looked like a slow place to us. But that was before they buried Shotgun Cheatham. He might have made it unnoticed all the way to the grave, except for his name. The county seat newspaper didn't want to run an obituary on anybody called Shotgun. But nobody knew any other name for him. This sparked attention from some of the bigger newspapers. One sent in a stringer to nose around the Coffee Pot Cafe for a human interest story since it was August, a slow month for news. The Coffee Pot was where people went to loaf, talk tall, and swap gossip. Mary Alice and I were of some interest when we dropped by because we were kin of Mrs. Dowdle's, who never set foot in the place. She said she liked to keep herself to herself, which was uphill work in a town like that. Mary Alice and I carried the tale home that a suspicious type had come off the train in citified clothes and a stiff straw hat. He stuck out a mile and was asking around about Shotgun Cheatham, and he was taking notes. Grandma had already heard it on the grapevine that Shotgun was no more, though she wasn't the first person people ran to with news. She wasn't what you'd call a popular woman. Grandpa Dowdle had been well thought of, but he was long gone. That was the day she was working tomatoes on the Black Iron Range, and her kitchen was hot enough to steam the calendars off the wall. Her sleeves were turned back on her big arms. When she heard the town was apt to fill up with newspaper reporters, her jaw clenched. Presently she said, "I'll tell you what that reporter's after. He wants to get the horse laugh on us because he thinks we're nothing but a bunch of hayseeds and no-count country people. We are, but what business is it of his?"
"Who was Shotgun Cheatham anyway?" Mary Alice asked.
"He was just an old reprobate who lived poor and died broke," Grandma said. "Nobody went near him because he smelled like a polecat. He lived in a chicken coop, and now they'll have to burn it down." To change the subject, she said to me, "Here, you stir these tomatoes and don't let them stick. I've stood in this heat till I'm half-cooked myself." I didn't like kitchen work. Yesterday she'd done apple butter, and that hadn't been too bad. She made that outdoors over an open fire, and she'd put pennies in the cauldron to keep it from sticking. Down at the Coffee Pot, they say Shotgun rode with the James boys.
"Which James boys?" Grandma asked.
"Jesse James," I said, "and Frank."
"They wouldn't have had him," she said. "Anyhow, them Jameses was Missouri people."
"They were telling the reporter Shotgun killed a man and went to the penitentiary."
"Several around here done that," Grandma said, "though I don't recall him being out of town any length of time. Who's doing all this talking?"
"A real old humped-over lady with buck teeth," Mary Alice said.
"Cross-eyed?" Grandma said. "That'd be Effie Wilcox. You think she's ugly now, you should have seen her as a girl, and she'd talk you to death. Her tongue's attached in the middle and flaps at both ends."
Grandma was over by the screen door for a breath of air.
"They said he'd notched his gun in 6 places, I said, pushing my luck. "They said the notches were either for banks he'd robbed or for sheriffs he'd shot."
"Was that Effie again? Never trust an ugly woman. She's got a grudge against the world," said Grandma, who was no oil painting herself.
She fetched up a sigh.
"I'll tell you how Shotgun got his name. He wasn't but about 10 years old, and he wanted to go out and shoot quail with a bunch of older boys. He couldn't hit a barn wall from the inside, and he had a sty in one eye. They were out there in the pasture without a quail in sight, but Shotgun got all excited being with the big boys. He squeezed off a round and killed a cow. Down she went. If he'd been aiming at her, she'd have died of old age eventually. The boys took the gun off him, not knowing who he'd plug next. That's how he got the name, and it stuck to him like flypaper. Any girl in town could have outshot him, and that includes me."
Grandma jerked a thumb at herself. She kept a 12-gauge double-barreled Winchester Model 21 behind the woodbox, but we figured it had been Grandpa Dowdle's for shooting ducks.
"And I wasn't no Annie Oakley myself, except with squirrels."
Grandma was still at the door, fanning her apron. Then in the same voice she said,
"Looks like we got company. Take them tomatoes off the fire."
A stranger was on the porch,
And when Mary Alice and I crowded up behind Grandma to see, it was the reporter. He was sharp-faced, and he'd sweated through his hatband.
"What's your business?"
Grandma said through screen wire, which was as friendly as she got.
"Ma'am, I'm making inquiries about the late Shotgun Cheatham."
He shuffled his feet, wanting to get one of them in the door, and he mopped up under his hat brim with a silk handkerchief. His Masonic ring had diamond chips in it.
"Who sent you to me?"
"I'm going door to door, ma'am. You know how ladies love to talk. Bless your hearts, you'd all talk the hind leg off a mule." Mary Alice and I both stared at that. We figured Grandma might grab up her broom to swat him off the porch. We'd already seen how she could make short work of peddlers even when they weren't lippy, and tramps didn't seem to mark her fence post. We suspected that you didn't get inside her house even if she knew you. But to our surprise, she swept open the screen door and stepped out onto the porch. I followed. So did Mary Alice once she was sure the snaggletooth Tom wasn't lurking around out there waiting to pounce.
"You a newspaper reporter?" she said. "Peoria?"
It was the flashy clothes, but he looked surprised.
"What they been telling you?"
"Looks like I got a good story by the tail," he said. "Last of the old owl hoot gunslingers goes to a pauper's grave. That kind of angle, ma'am. I wonder if you could help me flesh out the story some."
"Well, I got flesh to spare," Grandma said mildly. "Who's been talking to you?"
It was mainly an elderly lady.
"Ugly as sin? Calls herself Wilcox?" Grandma said. "She's been in the state hospital for the insane until just here lately. But as a reporter, I guess you knows that out."
Mary Alice nudged me hard, and the reporter's eyes widened.
"They tell you how Shotgun come by his name?"
"Opinion seemed to vary, ma'am."
"Oh, well, fame is fleeting," Grandma said. "He got it in the Civil War."
The reporter's hand hovered over his breast pocket, where a notepad stuck out.
"Oh, yes, Shotgun went right through the war with the Illinois Volunteers. Shiloh in the spring of 62, and he was with U.S. Grant when Vicksburg fell. That's where he got his name. Grant gave it to him, in fact. Shotgun didn't hold with government-issue firearms. He shot rebels with his old Remington pump action that he'd used to kill quail back here at home."
Now Mary Alice was yanking on my shirt tail. We knew kids lie all the time, but Grandma was no kid, and she could tell some whoppers. Of course, the reporter had been lied to big time up at the cafe, but Grandma's lies were more interesting, even historical. They made Shotgun look better while they left Effie Wilcox in the dust.
"He was always a crack shot," she said, winding down. "Come home from the war with a line of medals bigger than his chest."
"And yet he died penniless," the reporter said in a thoughtful voice.
"Oh, well, he'd sold off them medals and give the money to war widows and orphans."
A change crossed the reporter's narrow face. Shotgun had gone from kill-crazy gunslinger to war hero marksman, philanthropist even. He fumbled his notepad out and was scribbling. He thought he'd hit pay dirt with Grandma.
"It's all a matter of record," she said. "You could look it up."
He was ready to wire in a new story. "Civil War hero, hand-picked by U.S. Grant, called to the great campground in the sky." Something like that.
"And he never married?" "Never did," Grandma said. "He broke Effie Wilcox's heart. She's bitter still, as you see."
"And now he goes to a pauper's grave with none to mark his passing," the reporter said, which may have been a sample of his writing style.
"They tell you that?" Grandma said. "They're pulling your legs, sonny. You drop by the coffee pot and tell them you heard that Shotgun's being buried from my house with full honors. He'll spend his last night above ground in my front room, And you're invited.
The reporter backed down the porch stairs, staggering under all this new material.
Much obliged, ma'am, he said. Happy to help, Grandma said.
Mary Alice had turned loose of my shirt tail. What little we knew about grown-ups didn't seem to cover Grandma. She turned on us.
Now I've got to change my shoes and walk all the way up to the lumberyard in this heat, she said, as if she hadn't brought it all on herself.
Up at the lumberyard, they'd be knocking together Shotgun Cheatham's coffin and sending the bill to the county, and Grandma had to tell them to bring that coffin to her house, with Shotgun in it.
By nightfall, a green pine coffin stood on two sawhorses in the bay window of the front room, and people milled in the yard. They couldn't see Shotgun from there because the coffin lid blocked the view. Besides, a heavy gauze hung from the open lid and down over the front of the coffin to veil him. Shotgun hadn't been exactly fresh when they discovered his body. Grandma had flung open every window, but there was a peculiar smell in the room. I'd only had one look at him when they'd carried in the coffin, and that was enough. I'll tell you just two things about him. He didn't have his teeth in, and he was wearing bib overalls. The people in the yard still couldn't believe Grandma was holding open house. This didn't stop the reporter who was haunting the parlor, looking for more flesh to add to his story. And it didn't stop Mrs. L.J. Weidenbach, the banker's wife, who came leading her father, an ancient codger half her size in full Civil War Union blue.
"We are here to pay our respects at this sad time," Mrs. Weidenbach said when Grandma let them in. "When I told Daddy that Shotgun had been decorated by U.S. Grant and wounded three times at Bull Run, it brought it all back to him, and we had to come."
Her old daddy wore a forage cap and a decoration from the Grand Army of the Republic, and he seemed to have no idea where he was. She led him up to the coffin, where they admired the flowers. Grandma had planted a pitcher of glads from her garden at either end of the pine box. In each pitcher, she'd stuck an American flag. A few more people willing to brave Grandma came and went, but finally we were down to the reporter, who'd settled into the best chair, still nosing for news. Then who appeared at the front door but Mrs. Effie Wilcox, in a hat?
"Mrs. Dowdle, I've come to set with you overnight and see our brave old soldier through his last watch."
In those days, people sat up with a corpse through the final night before burial. I'd have bet money Grandma wouldn't let Mrs. Wilcox in for a quick look, let alone overnight. But, of course, Grandma was putting on the best show possible to pull wool over the reporter's eyes. Little though she seemed to think of townspeople, she thought less of strangers. Grandma waved Mrs. Wilcox inside, and in she came, her eyes all over the place. She made for the coffin, stared at the blank white gauze, and said,
"Don't he look natural?"
Then she drew up a chair next to the reporter. He flinched because he had it on good authority that she'd just been let out of an insane asylum.
"Warm, ain't it?"
she said, straight at him, but looking everywhere. The crowd outside finally dispersed. Mary Alice and I hung at the edge of the room, too curious to be anywhere else.
"If you're here for the long haul," Grandma said to the reporter, "how about a beer?"
He looked encouraged, and Grandma left him to Mrs. Wilcox, which was meant as a punishment. She came back with three of her home brews, cellar cool. She brewed beer to drink herself, but these three bottles were to see the reporter through the night. She wouldn't have expected her worst enemy, Effie Wilcox, to drink alcohol in front of a man. In normal circumstances, the family recalls stories about the departed to pass the long night hours. But these circumstances weren't normal,
And quite a bit had already been recalled about Shotgun Cheatham anyway. Only a single lamp burned, and as midnight drew on, the glads drooped in their pitchers. I was wedged in a corner, beginning to doze, and Mary Alice was sound asleep on a throw rug. After the second beer, the reporter lolled, visions of Shotgun Civil War glories no doubt dancing in his head. You could hear the tick of the kitchen clock. Grandma's chin would drop, then jerk back. Mrs. Wilcox had been humming Rock of Ages, but tapered off after, "Let me hide myself in thee." Then there was the quietest sound you ever heard. Somewhere between a rustle and a whisper. It brought me around, and I saw Grandma sit forward and cock her head. I blinked to make sure I was awake, and the whole world seemed to listen. Not a leaf trembled outside, but the gauze that hung down over the open coffin moved, twitched. Except for Mary Alice, we all saw it. The reporter sat bolt upright, and Mrs. Wilcox made a little sound. Then nothing. Then the gauze rippled, as if a hand had passed across it from the other side. And in one place it wrinkled into a wad, as if somebody had snagged it, as if a feeble hand had reached up from the coffin depths in one last desperate attempt to live before the dirt was shoveled in. Every hair on my head stood up.
"Naw,"
Mrs. Wilcox said, strangling. She pulled back in her chair, and her hat went forward.
"Naw."
The reporter had his chair arms in a death grip.
"Sweet mother of—"
But Grandma rocketed out of her chair.
"Whoa, Shotgun," she bellowed. "You've had your time, boy. You don't get no more."
She galloped out of the room faster than I could believe. The reporter was riveted, and Mrs. Wilcox was sinking fast. Quicker than it takes to tell, Grandma was back, and already raised to her apron's shoulder was the 12-gauge Winchester from behind the woodbox. She swung it wildly around the room, skimming Mrs. Wilcox's hat, and took aim at the gauze that draped the yawning coffin. Then she squeezed off around. I thought that sound would bring the house down around us. I couldn't hear right for a week. Grandma roared out, "Rest in peace, you old—" Then she let fly with the other barrel. The reporter came out of the chair and whipped completely around in a circle. Beer bottles went everywhere. The straight route to the front door was in Grandma's line of fire, and he didn't have the presence of mind to realize she'd already discharged both barrels. He went out a side window, head first, leaving his hat and his notepad behind. Which he feared more, the living dead or Grandma's aim, he didn't tarry to tell. Mrs. Wilcox was on her feet hollering,
"The dead is walking, and Mrs. Dowdle's gunning for me."
She cut and ran out the door and into the night. When the screen door snapped to behind her, silence fell. Mary Alice hadn't moved. The first explosion had blasted her awake, but she naturally thought that Grandma had killed her, so she didn't bother to budge. She says the whole experience gave her nightmares for years after. A burned powder haze hung in the room, cutting the smell of Shotgun Cheatham. The white gauze was black rags now, and Grandma had blown the lid clear off the coffin. She'd have blown out all three windows in the bay, except they were open. As it was, she'd pitted her woodwork bad and topped the snowball bushes outside. But apart from scattered shot, she hadn't disfigured Shotgun Cheatham any more than he already was. Grandma stood there savoring the silence. Then she turned toward the kitchen with the 12-gauge loose in her hand.
"Time you kids was in bed,"
she said, as she trudged past us. Apart from Grandma herself, I was the only one who'd seen her big old snaggle-toothed tomcat streak out of the coffin and over the windowsill when she let fire. And I supposed she'd seen him climb in, which gave her ideas. It was the cat, sitting smug on Shotgun Cheatham's breathless chest, who'd batted at the gauze the way a cat will. And he sure lit out the way he'd come when Grandma fired just over his ragged ears, as he'd probably used up 8 lives already. The cat in the coffin gave Grandma Dowdle her chance. She didn't seem to have any time for Effie Wilcox, whose tongue flapped at both ends. But she had even less for newspaper reporters who think your business is theirs. Courtesy of the cat, she'd fired around, so to speak, in the direction of each. Though she didn't gloat, she looked satisfied. It certainly fleshed out her reputation and gave people new reason to leave her in peace. The story of Shotgun Cheatham's last night above ground kept the Coffee Pot Cafe fully engaged for the rest of our visit that summer. It was a story that grew in the telling, in one of those little towns where there's always time to ponder all the different kinds of truth. The Mouse in the Milk, 1930. From something Dad said, it had dawned on Mary Alice and me that our trip down to Grandma's was meant to be an annual event. Mary Alice pitched a fit. It meant another week of summer vacation away from her friends, Beverly and Audrey. Besides, she said she wasn't over last year's visit yet. One night she'd have a nightmare about old Shotgun Cheatham sitting up in his coffin. And on the night after that, she'd dream that Grandma's big old tomcat was jumping at her. Or so she said. But having no choice, we went. If any of us had grown over the year, it was Grandma herself, and she still seemed to prize her privacy as much as ever. She mostly stayed home, because she said the whole town was a slum, and she didn't give 2 hoots about it, and she wouldn't even have a radio in her house. Mary Alice brought her jump rope to keep herself occupied, though she said jumping rope by yourself was the loneliest job in the world. I took a giant jigsaw puzzle to put together. It was supposed to depict Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh and his airplane, the Spirit of St. Louis. There wasn't room for it in our Chicago apartment, but in the summers, Grandma took down the stove that heated her front room, so there was space to leave a card table up. One night, soon after we arrived, I was working on the puzzle, and Grandma was drowsing in her platform rocker. She said she never slept, but she had to wake herself up to go to bed. Earlier, before it got dark, Mary Alice had been jumping rope outside. There weren't a lot of sidewalks in Grandma's town, but a strip of concrete ran from her front door out to the countrified mailbox beside the road. Grandma and I had been listening to Mary Alice.
"Jump," said Coolidge. "Jump," said Hoover. "Jump," said the driver of the furniture mover.
And Mary Alice's personal favorite,
"I had a letter from Nellie, and what do you think it said? Nellie had a baby, and its hair was red. Now how many hairs were on that head? 1, 2, 3.
When she got up to 180, Grandma called her inside. So now Mary Alice was sulking somewhere. Grandma's breathing was steady, the way it got before she started snoring. Then I heard a horse clopping past. That was no rare thing around here, but I noticed the silence when the horse stopped outside. Then right away heels kicked its sides, and the horse galloped off. It was a sound right out of a Tom Mix movie. I was reaching for a puzzle part that was just blue sky when a flash of light filled the bay window. Then an explosion shook the house and made my puzzle jump.
It wasn't as loud as the time Grandma squeezed off two rounds right here in the front room, but it brought her out of her chair. Like a ship under sail, she made for the front door. Mary Alice appeared from somewhere, and we both looked around Grandma into the night. You could barely see a stump out by the road. It was the post that had held the mailbox. But the mailbox was gone in several directions. We heard a piece of metal slide down the shingles of the roof, bounce off the gutter, and fall through the snowball bushes. Somebody on horseback had blown Grandma's mailbox sky high. The 4th of July was over, but there were still plenty of loose fireworks around. And this was no small charge, not a baby waker or even a torpedo. This could have been the work of a cherry bomb. Grandma planted her big fists on her big hips and her jaw clenched in a familiar way.
"Cowgills," she said. Like that explained it.
Grandma slept in a room downstairs to save herself the stairs. Mary Alice and I had rooms upstairs. They were sparsely furnished, with iron bedsteads and a lot of dead bugs on the sills. After I got used to how quiet the country was at night, I slept good up there. But I lay awake that night, recalling the sound when Grandma's mailbox was blown to smithereens. I was 10, the age when things blowing up interested me. But I wondered who'd dare do this to Grandma. My eyelids drooped, and it was morning. The smell of breakfast wafted up from the kitchen. You had to be downstairs on time and in your place, but Grandma's breakfasts were worth it. Pancakes and corn syrup, fried ham and potatoes and onions, anything you wanted and as much. Mary Alice and I were at the table, and Grandma was at the stove turning one last round of pancakes when we got a visitor on the back porch. We all looked. The screen on the door blurred her, but it was Grandma's old enemy, Mrs. Effie Wilcox. She didn't make free to rap on the door. She just stood out on the porch in a faded apron and broken boots, working her hands.
"Mrs. Dowdle, hooey,"
she called out in a tragic voice. Grandma strolled over to the door.
"What now?"
she said through screen wire. Mrs. Wilcox moaned.
"First of all," she said, "can I use it?"
She nodded down the back path to the cob house and the privy, and she didn't mean the cob house.
"Feel free," Grandma said. "Take a pew."
But Mrs. Wilcox just stood there on the porch, wringing her hands.
"I'm so nervous. I don't know if..." "What's come over you?"
Grandma said in her least interested voice. Mrs. Wilcox whimpered.
"Send them kids out of your kitchen, so I can tell you."
"They're having their breakfast," Grandma said, "and they're from Chicago, so they've heard everything."
"Well, it was last night," Mrs. Wilcox said. "They come on my place and wrenched up my you-know-what by the posts and flung it all over the yard."
"They knocked over your privy 3 months ahead of Halloween?"
Grandma was interested at last.
"What's the world coming to?"
"That's what I said," Mrs. Wilcox replied. "I'm too nervous to live. All the laws of civilization has broke down and town life is getting too dangerous. My only consolation is that there's a prayer meeting at church tomorrow night, and I've got me some praying to do."
"Do that,"
Grandma said. But Mrs. Wilcox couldn't wait another minute. She darted off the porch and down the path to our privy. Grandma settled into her chair to smother her last pancake with corn syrup. Then once again she said,
"Cowgills!"
Presently, Mary Alice slipped down from her chair and headed outside. When she got to the screen door, Grandma said,
I wouldn't use the privy all morning if I was you.
The next morning, when I came into the kitchen, a sight stopped me dead in the door. Behind me, Mary Alice pulled up short, too. Next to a box of shells, Grandpa Dowdle's old double-barrel Winchester Model 21 was on the kitchen table, along with a greasy rag, like Grandma meant to clean it. Just the sight of that gun made my ears ring. Then I saw somebody besides Grandma was in the kitchen, over by the door. He was a big, tall galoot of a kid with narrow eyes. His gaze kept flitting to the shotgun. The uniform he had on was all white with a cap to match. In his hand was a wire holder for milk bottles. He was ready to make his escape, but Grandma was saying,
"I hope I have better luck with your milk today than the last batch. I found a dead mouse in your delivery yesterday."
The kid's narrow eyes widened.
"No, you never," he said.
"Be real careful about calling a customer a liar," she remarked. "I had to feed that milk to the cat, and the mouse too, of course."
"No," the kid said, reaching around for the knob on the screen door behind him. Grandma was telling one of her whoppers. If she'd found a mouse in the milk, she'd have exploded like the mailbox. She was telling a whopper, and I wondered why.
"And another thing," she said. "I won't be needing a delivery tomorrow, neither milk nor cream. I'm going away."
First we'd heard of it. Mary Alice nudged me hard.
"I'll be gone tonight and all day tomorrow, and I don't want the milk left out where it'll sour. I won't pay for it. I'm taking my grandkids on a visit to my cousin Leota Shrewsbury."
Another whopper, and a huge one. Grandma off on a jaunt, and us with her? I didn't think so. She didn't do things that cost, and she never told anybody her business. Turning from the stove, she pretended surprise at seeing Mary Alice and me there, though she had eyes in the back of her head.
"Why, there's my grandkids now," she pointed us out with a spatula. "They're from Chicago. Gangs run that town, you know," she told the kid. "My grandson's in a gang, so you don't want to mess with him. He's meaner than he looks."
I hung in the doorway, bug-eyed and short. She was saying I, Joey Dowdle, was a tough guy from Chicago, and this kid was twice my size. He could eat me for lunch.
"This here's Ernie Cowgill," she said, finishing off the introductions.
With a sneer at me, Ernie Cowgill disappeared through the door and stomped off the porch.
"Grandma,"
I croaked,
"you'll get me killed."
She waved that away.
"I just said that for your protection. He'll be scared of you now. He'd believe anything. He's only in fourth grade."
"Grandma, he's at least 16.
"That's right, and still in fourth grade," she said. "He's the runt of the Cowgill litter. He's got three older brothers, and they're big bruisers. They're the ones you wouldn't want to meet up with in a dark alley."
She swept shotgun shells and the greasy rag off the kitchen table and put them all back behind the woodbox. Then she nodded at Mary Alice to set the table for breakfast. When we sat down to eat, I said,
"Grandma, what was the shotgun for?"
"Bait,"
she said.
"Who's cousin Leota Shrewsbury?"
Mary Alice asked.
"Who?"
Grandma said. I lurked pretty near home all day. I didn't even go uptown to the Coffee Pot Cafe for fear I'd run into Ernie Cowgill and his brothers. Now I remembered where I'd heard the name. The horse-drawn milk wagon that delivered to the door had a sign on its side that read, "Cowgill's Dairy Farm. From our clover-fed cows to your kitchen. Strictly sanitary. Farm-fresh eggs are specialty." In fact, I'd seen Ernie driving it standing up, handling the reins through a hole in the front window of the wagon. Even at a distance, he looked like somebody you wouldn't want to know better. It may have been just a coincidence that a family named Cowgill ran the dairy. I never knew. Noticing how close to home I was keeping, Grandma told me to weed the garden. You didn't want to hang around her too close, or she'd give you a job. The garden ran neat and tidy from the back porch down to the cob house beside the yard where she stretched her clothesline. I weeded through the heat of the day, and every time I got down by the cob house, I had a vision of all four Cowgill brothers stepping out of it. I could picture them hanging me from the eaves by my belt and taking turns slapping me to sleep. But I saw nothing but the crossed paws of the old tomcat napping just inside the door. The two rows of green onions made my eyes water, and the smell was making me woozy. I was thinking seriously of heat stroke when I heard Mary Alice shriek in the kitchen. She was no screamer, so it brought me to my feet. Now I thought Ernie Cowgill had gotten in and pounced on her. I jumped the garden rows, pounding for the house. But it was only Grandma and Mary Alice in the kitchen. Mary Alice's eyes were big as quarters, like Orphan Annie's, and she had both hands clapped over her mouth. Grandma towered over the table. Held high in her hand was a mouse trap, with a mouse still in it, a good-sized mouse. Its tail dangled down so far, it looked like one of the flypaper strips that hung from her kitchen ceiling. The spring on the trap had caught the mouse at the neck and nearly pulled his head loose. He was hanging by a thread and not a pretty sight. Mary Alice had already gone into shock. This was one more of those experiences she says gave her nightmares for years. Grandma examined her catch. Now she moved the trap into position over the mouth of an empty bottle. She eased up the spring and the mouse dropped straight in. He hit the bottom of the bottle with a soft thump. She turned back to the drain board and picked up another bottle full of milk, fresh, I suppose, from Ernie Cowgill's morning delivery. Without spilling a drop, she poured milk into the bottle on the table. Mary Alice and I watched like two paralyzed people as the milk rose around the mouse's furry gray body until his whiskers began to float. As the milk closed over his head, Mary Alice bolted. If the back door had been latched, she'd have gone straight through screen wire. Now Grandma was fitting a paper lid over the milk and mouse bottle. I knew not to ask why she was doing this. I didn't even want to know. Mary Alice didn't come back in the house till supper time. Then she didn't want any supper. I watched her move green beans and fat back around the plate with the fork big in her small hand. Grandma ate hearty. After a big wedge of layer cake, she pulled back from the table.
"Let's step right along and get them dishes washed and dried and put up," she said.
She was in a hurry, and I couldn't see why. But then I couldn't see a moment ahead. There was still some evening left, but the light was fading. Grandma stayed in the kitchen after we'd wandered into the front room. But as Mary Alice was reaching for her jump rope to take outside, Grandma turned up and said, "Not tonight." Mary Alice glowered, but said nothing. She flopped on the settee and fidgeted. Then she started to go upstairs. She'd brought a book called The Hidden Staircase by Carolyn Keene, and she liked reading in bed.
"Not tonight," Grandma said.
She sat at her ease in the platform rocker, with her sewing basket at her feet. She didn't do much fancy needlework, but she mended everything. Mary Alice came over to lean against me while I worked on Colonel Lindbergh. When it got so dark I couldn't see the puzzle, I reached to turn on the lamp, but Grandma said, "Not tonight."
By then, we had to know we were in for something.
"Shut the front door," Grandma told Mary Alice, who was just a little gray shape, mouse-like, as she went over to close it.
"And shoot the bolt across," said Grandma, who never locked her doors.
Now we three were only outlines in the dark parlor. Some plot was afoot. Mary Alice edged back on the settee. We were all waiting for something. It was dark now. I could picture what the house looked like from outside. Locked up, not a light showing upstairs or down. All of us gone away to visit Cousin Leota Shrewsbury, who didn't exist. Half an hour passed. Then Grandma spoke, making us leap.
"We could tell ghost stories," she said.
"Not tonight,"
Mary Alice said in a small voice. Later, much later, we heard something. The snowball bushes outside the window swayed gently. I barely saw Grandma's hand come up to stroke her cheek. We didn't breathe for listening. Then footsteps on the back porch, creeping, then more confident. After all, nobody was home. A hand closed over the knob on the screen door to the kitchen and found it latched. We heard a little sawing, singing sound as a file began to slice through screen wire. From the settee, Mary Alice made some tiny, terrified sound. Grandma reached down for something in her sewing basket. The darkness made me see pinwheels like sparklers. I just managed to notice Grandma's rocker was rocking and she wasn't in it. She was standing over me.
"Keep just behind me," she whispered.
I followed her across the room to the kitchen. You wouldn't believe a woman that heavy could be so light on her feet. She floated, and we moved like some strange beast, big in front, small behind. Now we were by the door to the kitchen, and I heard the scuffle of heavy feet in there on the crinkly linoleum. Grandma turned back to me. Under my nose, she struck a wooden match with her thumbnail. Men strike a match one-handed, but you never see a woman doing that. She hid the flare of the flame with herself and touched the match to something in her other hand. It sizzled. Then she leaned down and rolled it into the invisible kitchen. Seconds passed. Then once more Grandma's house erupted in sound and light. Blue lightning flashed in the kitchen, and for a split second you could see every calendar on the wall in there. Then an almighty explosion like the crack of doom. She'd rolled a cherry bomb across the floor, and it went off right under the 8 feet of the Cowgill brothers, the three big bruisers, and Ernie. Grandma shoved me past her into the kitchen.
"Pull the chain on the ceiling light," she said.
And I did. When I turned back to her, Grandpa Dowdle's shotgun was wedged into her shoulder. I dodged out of her way, and there stood all four Cowgill brothers. They were deaf as posts and too scared to move even before they realized they were looking down both barrels of the gun they'd come to steal. All of them wore manure-caked steel-toed boots, so that had saved their toes from being blown off. But a singed smell came from their pants. The cherry bomb had scared them witless, except for Ernie, who was witless anyway. But he was the only one who could speak.
"I'm dead," he said. "I'm dead. Oh, yes, I'm dead."
"Skin to the church and get their ma and pa," Grandma said briefly to me.
"Which church?"
"Holy Rollers," she said, "by the lumber yard, and step on it. I've got an itchy trigger finger."
"I'm dead," Ernie said.
I raced like the wind through the nighttime town. I sprinted past the business block and across the tracks by the depot toward the lumber yard.
Then I began to hear singing with a ragtime beat, accompanied by tambourines.
Wash me clean of all I've been, and hang me out to dry. Purify me thought and deed, that I may dwell on high.
The church was no bigger than a one-room schoolhouse, but it seemed to be packed to the rafters. The rail outside was thick with horses hitched to wagons. One of the wagons was from Cowgill's Dairy Farm. Light and song were pouring out of the open doorway. I stood in it, remembering I didn't know what the Cowgill's Ma and Pa looked like. Besides, all I could see were the backs of people's heads. Then I got lucky. Mrs. Effie Wilcox sat at the end of a pew. I knew her from her hat. Her hands were high above her head, swaying in the air, and she was singing with the rest.
Drive the devil from my soul, tie him to a tree. Let me rise into the skies, that I may dwell with thee.
I sidled down the side aisle, breathing heavy. Every minute counted, and I didn't know how long this hymn might last. It sounded like it could have a lot of verses.
Hate the sin, but love the sinner, though let him feel the rod. Lift me like a little child, that I may dwell with.
I tapped Mrs. Wilcox on the shoulder. She jerked around.
It's a miracle,
she hollered out.
The first Dowdle ever seen in the house of the Lord. Hallelujah! One more sinner gathered in.
Listen, Mrs. Wilcox, I said, urgent in her ear. Where are the Cowgills? It's kind of important.
The Cowgills?
She said.
Why, they're right here next to me. Where else would they be? They've been saved, and now you...
Listen, Mrs. Wilcox, Grandma blew up all four of their boys with a cherry bomb. Now she's got them pinned down with a shotgun.
Mrs. Wilcox's mouth opened in a silent scream. Then all four of us, Mr. and Mrs. Cowgill, Mrs. Wilcox, and me, were in the swaying milk wagon behind the galloping horse. There aren't any seats in a milk wagon, so we clung to the sides and each other. For somebody too nervous to live, Mrs. Wilcox stood the trip pretty well. The wagon bounced across Grandma's side yard. Now we were all tumbling down and racing each other to the back door. To keep up, both ladies held their skirts high. We burst into the kitchen, and it seemed that nobody had moved a muscle in there. The butt of the shotgun was still buried in Grandma's shoulder, and she was squinting down the barrels. The Cowgill boys looked like they were on the chain gang already. I got my first real look at their Ma and Pa. She was kind of a faded lady, and he had a milder look than his bruiser boys. They were all a lot taller than he was.
Now, now, Mr. Cowgill said, what have we here?
What we have here, Grandma said, is breaking and entering, burglary and pilfering, reform school for the youngest one, the penitentiary for the overgrown ones. Unless my trigger finger gives way to temptation. They wanted this shotgun, and they're liable to get it right between the eyes.
The ceiling light glinted wickedly off her spectacles.
And they tore down Effie Wilcox's specialty house. Tell it, Effie. You knew at the time who the culprits was who kicked your privy to kingdom come.
Mrs. Wilcox whimpered. Now, now, Mrs. Dowdle, Mr. Cowgill said. This is nothing more than a misunderstanding. My boys aren't broke out with brains, you know. I have an idea they just wandered into the wrong house.
Oh, they wandered into the wrong house, all right,
Grandma said,
and they'd already blowed up the wrong mailbox.
Mrs. Dowdle, compose your soul in patience, Mr. Cowgill said. And put up that shotgun. It don't look ladylike. I was tempted to cover my ears because that alone was enough to make Grandma squeeze off around. You know yourself, Mrs. Dowdle. Boys will be boys. They's high-spirited. They'll settle down in time and all be good Christian men. Their ma and I have set them a good example. I thought Mr. Cowgill was going way out on a limb, but strangely, Grandma lowered the shotgun.
Well, you know best, being their pa, she said calmly.
She stood the shotgun against the wall and folded her arms before her.
But get them out of my kitchen, and you owe me for the screen wire they cut to get in. And I'll want me a new mailbox, a good galvanized iron one, even if it runs you $3.
Mr. Cowgill paled at that, but said, There now, I knew you'd see sense, Mrs. Dowdle. Boys go through these phases. Come along, boys. He patted his biggest bruiser's shoulder, and all four of them were trying hard not to smirk. Mrs. Cowgill left first, supported by Mrs. Wilcox. Then the bruisers and Ernie trooped out. Their paw was just at the door when Grandma said,
Not so fast, Cowgill.
He turned, unwilling, back.
I'll be interested in your explanation for that.
She pointed to the milk bottle that nobody had noticed, though it stood on the kitchen table. The milk in it was more pink than white now, but you could see the mouse inside. In fact, it had swelled up some. What the?
You can say that again,
Grandma remarked. Sweat popped out on Mr. Cowgill's brow.
Mrs. Dowdle, you don't mean to tell me.
I don't mean to tell you a thing. There stands the evidence.
Mrs. Dowdle, it can't be. We're strictly sanitary. We strain our milk.
Sweat ran in rivers off his pate.
I don't doubt it, she said. After all, you've got to keep your good name in a town like this.
Then how?
A bunch of worthless boys who'd ransack the town every night is apt to drop a mouse in the milk just before delivering to my door. Your big ones is perfectly capable of putting Ernie up to it. He's simple. After all, they blew up my mailbox, and Effie Wilcox has to use my privy. Thugs like yours, who prey on two old, helpless widow women such as Effie and myself, is liable to get up to anything. Many more mice in the milk, and your customers will start keeping their own cows again.
Mr. Cowgill shrank. His dry mouth worked wordlessly, and there was fear in his eyes. Naked fear. He didn't mind what his boys did to the town, but now he saw his business going down the drain, so to speak. Mrs. Dowdle, he said in a broken voice, what do you want?
Justice, Grandma said.
A pause fell upon them. Grandma and Mr. Cowgill seemed to have a moment of complete understanding. Then he said, What'll I use? She nodded across the kitchen to the sink. In his earthly life, Grandpa Dowdle had shaved over that sink. The mirror still hung there from his time, and beside it a long leather strop for sharpening the edge on his cutthroat razor. Mr. Cowgill edged around the kitchen table and pulled the strop off the wall. Then he left. Grandma and I filled the doorway to watch. It was dark out there, but you could see the lumpish shapes of the Cowgill boys hanging around the milk wagon waiting for their paw. They didn't have to wait a minute more. Line up according to age, he called out, snapping the long leather strop above his head. Then he wailed the tar out of every one of them. They squealed like stuck hogs, while Mrs. Cowgill lamented from the milk wagon. He took each by the arm in turn and gave them all what for. You could tell when he got to Ernie because a wavering voice cried out,
I'm dead.
At last, the milk wagon clattered out of the yard. Grandma stayed at the door as peace descended. The snap of the strop against Bruiser Britches seemed to linger in the night air. Mary Alice joined us. She'd made herself scarce once she'd seen Grandma grab up the shotgun. She was a little older now, a little wiser. Then back up the path came Mrs. Wilcox. You could see the shape of her hat bobbing against the dark. She'd been making a call at our privy on her way home.
"Night now,"
she called out, crossing the yard. "Night, Effie," Grandma called back to her worst enemy. Then she turned from the door, and I saw the look on her face. You had to study hard to see any expression at all, but it was a look I was coming to know. She appeared pretty satisfied at the way things had turned out. And she'd returned law and order to the town she claimed she didn't give two hoots about.